All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 30. In this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class, this is the final lecture of new material for part 2 of the course. So appropriately, it is the climax of archaism, by which I mean we have arrived at the most interesting part, the most compelling, the most exciting part of the story of the archaic world in the form of the Persian Empire. In archaic times, circa 3,000, onward for literally thousands of years, human beings lived at this archaic plateau. And they were not able to organize themselves in a way that would allow them to flourish to an extent beyond that archaic plateau. They knew how to grow crops, so they could, if they could find a good, fairly stable river valley system like that of the Nile or that of the Tigris and Euphrates, or in India you would find the Indus, or in China you would find the Yangtze River. If you could find a situation like that in nature that was relatively amenable to human life, and the climate was pretty stable and things were pretty gentle for you, then you could grow crops. And if you could figure out how to organize society, then you could maintain a fairly stable social system, and you could defend yourself against nomads. You could build something that would last. And people gradually figured out how to do that along very similar lines in all of what we call the River Valley civilizations. Egypt is certainly one, and Mesopotamia is another. So that's why we study the two of them, as they give us a good entry point into that general category that is the archaic world. And from there, if we go on to study world history, we can look at China, we can look at India, we can see very similar patterns of development, and we see the same stagnation. We see the same limits on the ability of human beings to flourish. So, there is that story of limited value to us, because we, very fortunately, live in a time in history where those limits have been surpassed, where human beings have devised institutions to support human life to a much greater degree. We have figured out, to some extent, though confusions and other problems remain, we certainly have done a better job of understanding the nature of individual rights and freedom. And we provide for that. And consequently, we, as a society, as a civilization, benefit from the productive effort of people who are pursuing their happiness, and who are creating all kinds of wonderful values within our social system. And in particular, we have this radical transformation that makes modern life so much greater than anything in the past, which is the Industrial Revolution. So we now here are sitting in the comfort of our homes, communicating on an instantaneous global network so that we can get the benefit of a good history education despite government schools, despite all of the other confusions that we have in terms of how our society functions. We can still get educated wherever we are in the world. We have such amazing benefits here to enjoy in this modern technological age. We live twice as long as human beings used to live, and we live such better lives. Such our quality of life is just staggering, in terms of, in compared to anything in the archaic past as well. So when we look back to it, it's definitely not something that where we,
where we are pining for that past, and it's certainly not something that we find a lot of values to mimic or to adopt and to propagate within our own lives. That we won't find stuff like that until we get to the Greeks and the Romans. But nonetheless, you know, the archaic phase of human civilization was a good first half at least. And then, well, with the Dark Ages, we went back to it. And in other civilizations like China and India, they were pretty much there all the way until the 19th century. So most of human civilization and still some parts of the world are still stuck in a very archaic framework of looking at life despite the advances in technology and so on. And so it's very substantial and it's very significant. And certainly if we want to honor what we have and really truly honor, appreciate, and sustain everything that we have in modern civilization, we need to study this. We need to understand, how did we rise up from that? Because there's nothing guaranteed in this world, certainly not the massive construct that is modern globalized civilization. It is an enormous, staggering accomplishment, and it is very difficult to sustain. Just ask the president, whose job it is, more than any other human being on this earth, to keep it all working. It's the hardest job on the planet. Because the American president has basically ever since about Teddy Roosevelt has made it his job, to take care of the whole planet, then, you know, that is just an amazing thing that has happened, but it requires an enormous amount of energy. And it's very difficult to do. And as you can see by looking around the world, there are constant and quite substantial threats to the maintenance of civilization. And so this is real stuff, that we are learning about and extremely relevant. So let's look at how far it is possible to go in an archaic framework, because that's what the Persians were able to do. They took it further than anybody had, which is why, you know, they became the greatest empire in the archaic world. So on the one hand, the obvious truth about the Persians, when we get to this, you know, massive empire of theirs, the obvious truth about that is that, and we can laugh about it, right? That it's just, you know, the biggest fish swallowing the other fish. And by that, we can kind of just mean it's one group of people that just happened to develop the military capacity to subdue others. Okay. And that by itself is unremarkable. And certainly in primitive life, we would, you know, it's not hard for one set of peoples to perhaps develop military tactics or perhaps a slightly harder type of iron or perhaps a steel alloy. It's gradually, we know, we work our way up into the Iron Age in archaic times, and we start to see some types of alloys that we call steel, primitive types of steel and so on. So we get different types of technology. We get different types of military tactics. We get just a variety of innovations that might allow one country to be more militarily powerful than another. All right. That's one thing. But, and that certainly is a part of what the Persians were able to do. We don't know of anything in particular of their methods that was especially unique or distinctive, but in that regard. But we know that they had it because they did what they did. So their military power was significant. But what else?
What were the other ingredients of this imperialism which takes you to this level and allows you to keep it over, you know, some extensive period of time? This particular empire lasted a couple hundred years, so that's not nothing. It experienced some profound disruptions over that period. And ultimately, it was conquered, as we shall see, by Alexander the Great. And then dismembered, and it didn't come back for hundreds and hundreds of years. But it was nonetheless a long-lived and very successful empire. So that's what I mean. It's a large, long-lived, successful empire. So that's what I mean by the climax of archaism. The Persians had a formula. And it's interesting to observe it. It's interesting to understand how they worked it and what were the components of it. So in addition to military, their military supremacy, what else did they have that helps us to understand the Persians and why they were a great empire? Well, the first of the ingredients that I would name, in addition to just pure, you know, raw military power and brutality and violence and all that standard barbaric stuff. In addition to that, I think that it's fair to say that one of the things that separates the Persian Empire from the others that it overtook was this somewhat ineffable characteristic, which means hard to measure, hard to grasp, hard to pin down. Ineffable is a good vocabulary word if you're not familiar with it. I'll write it. I'll chat it to you guys in case you want it. Ineffable. Kind of ineffable quality that was possessed of a significant number of its Persian rulers, which is a common denominator between them and the successful leaders of other empires. And that is what we call charisma. Or if we combine that with just their status, and this is very common in imperialism, we have what's called charismatic leadership. And consequently, we have a kind of an institution that we refer to as charismatic monarchy. All of those are nicely, closely allied. Of course, they all revolve around the idea of charisma. So when you hear that, anything come to mind? Other examples of it, and perhaps a definition. Up front, any thoughts? Theo, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think what would constitute a charismatic monarchy is the king, it has just this energy that makes people do what he wants and kind of just, like, gets everyone really excited to go, you know, conquer this territory.
Right, there you go. Right, it's an energy. It's a quality, it's a personality trait that great leaders have. So, you know, if we look at presidents of the United States, they're typically people who get elected to office like that tend to be charismatic people. President Obama is a charismatic person, and most presidents have been charismatic. They draw others to them. They are able to communicate in a way that is convincing. They have this aura about them that says, I'm a leader, and follow me. And people do. And it's a trait that some people develop, and they become kind of what we would call them kind of natural leaders. It's maybe an exaggeration to say. It's not necessarily, it's certainly a developed trait. It's certainly something that somebody learns to be in their lifetime. But this leadership quality, this energy, is one of the features of any, you know, high-ranking official in a government, a president, But it's not necessarily a feature of a monarchy. Why? How come we don't always get, you know, the charismatic part in the monarchy, Timothy?
Well, I think it's because there's a difference between a leader and a ruler. Because a ruler, like, a leader will say, like, a leader will, like, I don't really know how to explain it, but there's some, I feel like there's some difference between a leader and a ruler that sometimes gets left out in a monarchy.
Okay, yeah, you're onto it, but there's a reason why a ruler is different than, as you say, a leader. A leader is somebody who kind of will earn a position of leadership. But a ruler, how does he become the ruler, Abby?
Well, he probably inherits it. I mean, he might have earned it, but probably he inherited it.
Yeah, right. So which means he's not necessarily going to be really good at it. Right? Because, well, you know, this idea of inheritance is an institution that human beings generally practice. Well, the people who inherit something are not necessarily worthy of it. So that especially is the case with, you know, wealth in modern times. We often see that you'll get this really productive person, like a genius that will produce an enormous amount of wealth for a family. And then people of subsequent generations will be kind of dissolute or won't be able to sustain that productivity, and the family empire, the family wealth will dissolve, and they'll lose it. They'll waste away the money. And the same thing goes for monarchies. They tend to be dynastic. So who's to say that the child is going to be the equal of the father, right? And so on, all the way down the line. So there, you know, this dynasty of kings, it's called the Achaemenid, my spelling could be wrong there. Why don't I go find it on Wikipedia? Cyrus was the first one. There we are. The Achaemenid Empire, Achaemenid Dynasty. Achaemenes was the first. His name is given to the dynasty. Cyrus the Great, Cyrus the Second of Persia, was arguably the greatest of all of them. He was a great charismatic leader. He's the one who is responsible for most of what you see on the green map. Because when he rose to power, this was Persia. You can see it labeled on the map. On this older map, it says Persis. And the capital was Persepolis. Okay, so this is Persia. This is Media up here. Persians and the Medes were kind of cousins, neighboring powers. The Medes were the ones that had allied with the Babylonians to destroy Assyria. But somehow, mysteriously, Persia merged and conquered Media and took control of it. And from then on, it was just a meteoric rise of this empire. Under Cyrus, all of this stuff to the east was conquered and taken over. Now, it was relatively empty compared to other parts, let's say, of the map. But nonetheless, it's a very large swath of land, and it became integrated within the empire. So that means, you know, he ruled it. And from there, he made his way all the way to what we call Lydia. You can see it labeled over here on the western part of the Persian Empire, and conquered Lydia, which is what brought Persia into contact with the Greeks, because the Greeks had colonies on the other side of that sea, which is called the Aegean Sea. So they actually had colonies neighboring Lydia, and they had a pretty strong relationship with the king of Lydia, and were very acutely aware that Lydia had been conquered by the Persians. From there, Cyrus returned to Babylonia and conquered it. So this is all his. Almost all of this, about 90% of this, is due to Cyrus as a charismatic leader. And the thing that he did, which is a reflection of this charismatic monarchy, and which reveals, I would call it the secret ingredient of the Persian Empire, the success of the Persian Empire. When he got to Babylon, which he conquered, and by the way, I forgot to show you guys this last time, and this was on the self-test sheet that I posted. And if you hadn't noticed, there was another one before class. Usually I don't get it there until the very, very, you know, right before class. But this is Babylon, by the way, that is depicted here. And the Neo-Babylonians were the ones who built this exotic, colossal engineering feat, which was known as the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. So that's part of the clue in Charles Le Brun's painting of to where this, what this location is. He put this, you know, the big forest, basically, this conservatory up here on the top of a giant building. Those were known as the Hanging Gardens. So that's his way of illustrating that. So this is Babylon, but the man in gold is not Cyrus. So we'll get back to that. But anyway, at least now I'm giving this away in small chunks here. So the location of this painting is Babylon, which is, you know, right, the city that of the Neo-Babylonian Empire here. And well, what does Cyrus do when he conquers Babylon is very interesting. It made him a kind of cultural hero among the Jews. He freed them from their Babylonian captivity, from their Babylonian exile. So remember yesterday, starting with the Assyrians, the Jews began to be buffeted about by historical forces greater than theirs. They were forced into exile by the Assyrians. Then they were forced into exile by the Babylonians twice. And so large swaths of the Jewish population, the people of Judea, in Israel, were expelled from their homeland, and forced into other parts of the world. And so when Cyrus got to Babylon, he freed them. And he did something else. He let them go back to their homeland and allowed them to rebuild their religious temples. So this is why he got a reputation in Jewish culture, in Jewish history. Cyrus and the Achaemenid dynasty in general was very highly regarded by the Jewish people because they were freed by Cyrus. And the general principle that we're going to see here, which is the secret ingredient, the distinctive thing that the Persians did within their empire, was they practiced religious toleration. So, by which I mean the following. They let people keep their religion. They, in the world of Assyria, in the world of Babylon, Mesopotamia, that whole long chain of civilizations, or societies, what have you, kings, kingships. The way that it typically worked was when one city conquered another, the way that the culture interpreted that was that the god of the conquering city was believed to have defeated the god of the conquered city. So this is, you know, very much that archaic outlook that is very common from one civilization to another. The Egyptians, if they're going to explain the flooding of the Nile, they're not going to study meteorology. They're going to say that the gods are providing for Egypt. If one army defeats another, one city defeats another, one country defeats another, they are going to say that is because of the gods. Again, so any natural phenomenon is presumed to be directed by supernatural forces. And so in that universe, in particular, the god Marduk was viewed to have been kind of supreme in Mesopotamia. Because Marduk was the, as it says here, patron deity or the god of the city of Babylon. And so here's a nice bas-relief sketch of him with his wings and so on. So very much kind of a human figure with, again, kind of angel-like or bird-like qualities and stuff like that. And when we see kings of Mesopotamia or Assyria or what have you depicted in various inscriptions or things like that, they kind of look the same way. Oftentimes will be depicted in godlike fashion because, of course, we know that they are allies of whatever god it is, representatives on earth of a god, and they are divinely inspired and divinely sanctioned. So this representation becomes very iconic. Abby, go ahead.
Listening to you just saying that about how they always seem to look the same, all the gods, like, I was thinking, even before I heard you say that, like, they all, the Egyptian gods, these Mesopotamian gods, mm-hmm. they all have these big beards and headpieces and robes and...
Yeah, they're very grand, right? Because, of course, the idea of a god is the idea of something that is greater than human beings, right? Some agency that is much more spectacular, that actually has this efficacy and control over the universe, right? So, of course, it's got to be, in a human imagination, it's got to be great. It can't be just, you know, some small or frail thing. It's got to be the greatest thing. And it's not uncommon for primitive people to visualize that as a powerful male, but also some kind of, you know, other features, oftentimes animal traits that are considered powerful or something else like that. So you see a lot of things like the Sphinx and griffins and other creatures that are kind of hybrids and spectacular and magical in their qualities. Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very common. Getting back to the main theme here. The premise was, the belief was, that when one god overcame another, took his place in the pantheon and ruled from then on, that everybody had to worship that god, above all the others. So a conquered city's people had to change their religion. So if you were Ashur and you were conquered by Babylon, then you had to worship Marduk. And above all. And of course, if you were, for instance, like the Jewish people and had a very strongly held belief and would refuse to do such a thing, well, now you can understand why they would be treated very harshly by the Assyrians or the Babylonians or what have you. Right? They would not do that. They would not worship other people's gods. And so they were persecuted for that. And when Cyrus came along and freed them and allowed them to rebuild their temples and allowed them thereafter to practice their own religion, well, naturally they viewed that as a very beneficent thing. He was viewed as a heroic ruler, and lionized within their culture. And this was part of, this is the formula, right? If you want to rule people, you've got to figure out, well, what are those things that will trigger a rebellion? Right? How can you maintain your power? And the Persians were smart about this. Cyrus realized that there's only a handful of things that people are going to be willing to die for. And yeah, there are a bunch of material considerations. There's the, you know, if you're going to starve people to death and you're tyrannical, they might rise up against you. If you're going to attack their families, their most, you know, precious, you know, loved ones, you got to watch out about that too, because that's going to lead to blood feuds and what have you, and so on. Well, what's another thing that would, if you're going to steal all their wealth, they might rebel against you. On the other hand, you know, what are other values that people are willing to die and to kill for? Well, religion is certainly at the top of that list. So it is one of those precious values that people embrace really deeply. It matters greatly to them emotionally. And so as a ruler, if you want to control large swaths of land and people that have different religious beliefs, that's a very delicate issue. How do you do that? How do you control them? The Persians came upon this idea that you let them keep their religion. Don't force them to, you know, don't trigger them on that basis. And you'll have an easier time of it. Okay, absolutely true. Now we have to be careful not to adopt be careful to not naively praise the Persians for this and to suggest somehow that they were really nice guys because they let people keep their religion. Okay? There was zero recognition of rights. Okay? So when we're talking about religious toleration in an archaic framework, there's absolutely no recognition of the freedom of religion as a right. Okay? What is going on here is exclusively this. The Persians wanted to rule. They understood that religion was a trigger for rebellions. Therefore, they let people keep their religion. That's it. In order to rule them, they let them keep their religion. So that's not freedom of religion, and that's not individual rights, and there's nothing particularly nice about it. It's entirely pragmatic. They just wanted to control people, and they were smart about it. They knew that the best way to do that is not to try to force them to give up their beliefs, but rather to let them keep them. Abby.
And I hear that. I just wonder, did the people they conquered know that that was the reason they were letting them keep their religion?
Well, I think probably some did, and probably many didn't. Because, to be honest, I mean, most people, certainly in archaic times, were divorced from politics. What did they do? They grew food, right? Their lives were very, very simple. Whether they were farmers or artisans or what have you, their lives were completely governed by very basic patterns of behavior. Only some of them, elders within their clans or tribes, what have you, had any kind of awareness of broader politics. And larger groupings might be organized into kingdoms, and there might be a nobility there that might be able to kind of operate on a higher level and be aware of what was going on. And those people probably understood what was happening. I can't speak to any particular case here. But another thing about the system that the Persians implemented was they let local aristocracies stay in power. So that was another way of getting those people that would normally organize the rebellion to keep them within the system and to co-opt them, to essentially do the Persians' work for them. And so letting the people keep their religion, letting the people maintain their local aristocracies, all of that was basically, so if you're a normal, you know, regular person living your life, you might never know that you are now in the Persian Empire. I think that's an exaggeration, but you get my point, is that on a day-to-day level, your life didn't change. So why would you rebel? Right? I mean, people would rebel, they would get organized in large collectives and form up an army, well, because they had some wider awareness and motivation to fight for their way of life or their beliefs or what have you, right? But if there was no reason for that, and neither the lower ranks of society nor the upper ranks had any basis for rebelling, well, why would they? I mean, that is the key to this equation, to having the Persians maintain their power, is to make it as easy as possible to stay in the empire, to make it, you know, as painless, let's put it that way, as painless as possible. And therefore, people would just acquiesce. That's the idea. So the most interesting example of the Persians kind of brilliantly applying this principle came after Cyrus. It was his son Cambyses. And so here is Cambyses the second in particular. And as it says here at the top of the of his designations over here, not only was he the King of Kings, that was their title when it came to the Persian kings, but notice what it says here. He became the Pharaoh of Egypt. So he conquered Egypt, and what he did was he became the Pharaoh. Theo.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense because the Egyptian religion was based around the Pharaoh being a god king. So obviously whoever was the ruler had to be the god king. So he, and if they were going to let those people have their religion, then he would have to become the Pharaoh of Egypt.
Yeah, true. But now keep in mind that we're quite far along in Egyptian history, and we don't quite have the god king construct like we did before. Right? This is not the age of the pyramids. So this is a more pragmatic time. And the main concern here is to, again, co-opt the religious establishment and the aristocracy and let them keep their power. Make it painless. So if he becomes the Pharaoh and he performs Egyptian religious rites, he is basically saying to them, all of you guys get to keep what you got. Nothing changes except a little bit of that. It's got to go to us. The tribute. You got to send the tribute back to Persia, and you're going to worship me as the Pharaoh, and that's it. Nothing else changes. So why would people rebel? Right? I mean, what is the motivation if everybody who has power gets to keep their power? And everybody else, pretty much life goes on. So this is the kind of, you could say, the genius of the Persian imperial system. It was a light touch. It was a very careful, intelligent way to rule people. Now, of course, when you have charismatic monarchy, which definitely Cyrus and Cambyses are two good examples of it, there is one definite problem. For example, what happened after Charlemagne in the Kingdom of the Franks in Europe? Who remembers? Keen?
Did he not have, what was it, three sons who end up fighting over over the empire?
Yeah, right. It broke apart, right? Turns out three grandsons. There's always that little guy in the middle that everybody forgets. So it was his three grandsons, right? The whole thing fell apart, leading to the separation of Germany and France, two separate national countries thereafter for pretty much permanently. So yeah, right? Charismatic monarch, Charlemagne, Karl the Great. Charismatic monarch, Cambyses. When he dies, very hard to maintain order. And in fact, there was a
small conflict, a kind of civil war. And but it was good for Egypt in a sense, because apparently his son wasn't much. And instead, a nobleman named Darius, yes, a vacuum of power, Theo, you're exactly right. A nobleman named Darius, or Dariush, became the next ruler, took power. And here he is, right? He is the one here on the Behistun inscription. He is the one who commissioned that. He is the one who's going to initiate the Greco-Persian Wars. Dariush was also a great charismatic leader. And he was that because he took power. I mean, he was one of those. He filled that vacuum of power after the death of Cambyses, and was able to lead the empire again. And what we see in his time, and it's hard to know how much of it was due to him or Cyrus or any other, but what we see in this vast empire of the Persians, back to this imagery here that we have of the sheer scale of it, right? We have all the standard techniques for organized, you know, kingship on a grand scale. You've got to have, you necessarily have to delegate local power, right? This is not a time when you can leap into a jet airplane and get to the other side of the empire later in the day, right? So you've got to delegate local power. So you have, in the Persian Empire, you have characters that are called satraps. These are the nomarchs of the Persian world. Okay, these are the local rulers. But of course, satraps having a local power base are necessarily dangerous, necessarily corrupt, and you've got to keep an eye on them. You've got to really pay attention to what they're doing, because they're going to rebel and they're going to create a lot of trouble. So in order to avoid that, the Persians developed various methods of making sure that the whole system was organized. And so what we see in the Persian Empire is probably more of an evolution towards another kind of monarchy than anywhere else. And so we would call that in general, we would call it bureaucratic government. We're here, the key word here is bureaucracy. And I would basically say you've got charismatic monarchy and you've got bureaucratic monarchy. It's usually find one or the other. Or sometimes you don't have either, and that's the worst situation. But what we see in, for instance, the European Middle Ages, what we see in China, what we see anywhere where you have monarchy and you have the problem of charismatic monarchy and you want to try to solve that, the best solution that anybody's ever come up with in that archaic system is to develop a bureaucracy. And the key word inside of that is bureau, which is a French word. It means office. So, and crassy, right, at the end of the word, just like in democracy, means rule. So bureaucracy means rule through the officials. Rule by means of offices. Power by means of systematic organization, right? The incorporation of the government so that it functions like a well-oiled machine. It's not charismatic. It doesn't rely solely on a guy who knows how to tell people what to do. It relies instead on methods. It relies on procedures. It relies on techniques that are developed and transmitted in a professional capacity from one, you know, employee basically to another within the system.
and where people can become interchangeable within that. That's bureaucracy. The Persians developed the bureaucracy of imperialism, and this was a great reason why they were very successful. In particular, every satrap had a secretary. Bureaucracies always need secretaries. But the secretary was known as the king's ear, which some of you might remember. One of those things that kind of sticks out when you hear it. And so the king's ear was a spy. So in order to organize the satrapies, the king had this official within each of the satrapies that was the king's ear, and he spied on the satrap. And of course, you know, related what was going on in the satrapy to the king. Now, was the king necessarily going to get an accurate report from the king's ear? Maybe he was going to be co-opted into some kind of conspiracy against the king. So you had to monitor, you had to watch the watchers, right? And so in a bureaucracy, you have various levels of what in modern terms we call auditing. Right? You may have heard of this. An auditor, right, is somebody who is watching over stuff. Checking the books, making sure it all adds up, and that nobody's cheating. And so, in addition to the king's ear, there was a mobile commission that had its own army attached to it called the king's eye. And so this was basically a part of the bureaucracy. It moved throughout the empire randomly, would show up in any satrapy, and demand an accounting of everything that was going on, and check everything. It was like an inquisition. And so if things weren't being done properly, I mean, it had the authority to basically take care of business because it had an army of its own. And so if the satrap or the king's ear or whoever it was not doing their job, then they were in danger of their lives. Because the king's eye was the enforcement mechanism to make sure that the king was getting, you know, the proper information, getting the proper tribute, getting everything that he was supposed to as the emperor, right? As the king of kings. And a part of that, making this whole system work together, we're getting to the end here, was something that the Persians developed and that later on the Romans would perfect, and that was to make it possible for the emperor to have the best amount of information, to have the ability to project his power to any far reaches of the empire that was necessary as quickly as possible. So they began to develop a system of roads. And this one right here is actually labeled on this map, which is kind of the interstate of the Persian Empire, linking one of the Persian capitals, Susa, all the way to Lydia. So it was the best way that you could get all the way across, at least to the western extremity of the empire. So all of this was to rationalize, to organize the empire and make it function in its basic function, to make sure that it worked with the greatest amount of efficiency. And it all contributed to the Persian Empire being the climax of archaism, because it was the most ably managed, ruled empire in leading up to the classical period. It was huge. It was very successful. The kings were really good at what they were doing, and they were able to achieve something that nobody had been able to achieve before, nowhere near this scale. But what they didn't expect was that some troublemakers who had gotten the idea that freedom is a good thing, would put up such an enormous fight, the whole thing would come crumbling down. So, when we come back after the test next week is going to be our test week. It's going to be a little bit of a strange week because it's interrupted by Veterans Day. I'll explain that when we get to it on Monday. But when we return the week after that, we'll start to look at the Greeks. Now we really get to the good part. Alrighty, folks. That'll do it for the archaic world. Ready to move on? Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow in History Through R. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.